Former Republican Senator Olympia Snowe spent three terms in the Senate, was known for her ability to work both sides of the aisle. There's not much of that going on these days, and that's one of the reasons she decided not to seek re-election in 2012. She'll be in town next month to keynote a University of Missouri St. Louis Center for Ethics and Public Life event titled The Ethics of Political Dysfunction, What to Do When the System Breaks Down. I spoke with her yesterday and asked Senator Snowe first about the subject of our first segment, why achieving pay equity for women of color was moving so slowly.
It's a very good question. That's the unfortunate part of where we stand today within the economy. Frankly, in creating the quality jobs, and that women, African-American women, Hispanic women, you know, are receiving dollar for dollar what their male counterparts are getting in the workplace. And that's what we have to continue to fight and to work against. And that means making sure there is equity in the workplace.
But how do we achieve that? I mean, as I say, there's a law on the books that hopes to achieve this for women.
Well, you know, it's obviously identifying why the inequities exist. What is happening that needs to underscore what changes have to occur? You know, in fact, that there have been legislative initiatives before Congress in the past, and I think that, frankly, with some adjustments in some of these bills, that it would be very possible to be able to get legislation through that would begin to remedy some of the issues that exist and continue to exist in the workplace, and to make sure those inequities are addressed, whether it's in the workplace or in a court of law. I mean, for example, in the Lilly Ledbetter Act, it was to remove the statute of limitations that existed with respect to wage discrimination. And the statute of limitations was so limiting that it basically created a huge barrier ever remedying the problem when it existed in discriminating in terms of pay. For example, Lilly Ledbetter didn't discover until, you know, many years later.
Yeah.
And so all of that changed as a result of the law. And I think it's possible to address some of the pay equity issues in law if they could reach a bipartisan consensus on some of those initiatives that have been before the Congress in the past.
Well, I guess that brings us to the subject at hand then, and the potential for any kind of agreement these days on Capitol Hill amongst the two parties. It just doesn't seem to be in the cards.
Well, you know, unfortunately, Don, that's the case, but it doesn't have to be that way, because I think that it's more for the ambitions and the politics on both sides, rather than trying to address the issues and the problems at hand to build a consensus and a solution to those issues. I think that the whole legislative process and governance has shifted, you know, from problem solving to politics. I mean, it becomes all about the next election, all about the politics of the issue, the winning and the losing, who's for and against, as opposed to how do you really address the best solutions for the problems at hand. I mean, as you cite with pay equity, for example, there has been a bill that's been before Congress before, but there's not been the process by which to bridge both sides on some of the issues where there are differences. I mean, obviously, there's going to be differences on a number of issues, and it's going to be probably differences on all of the issues that come before Congress for the most part. The question is how you resolve those differences and how you reconcile the differences politically and philosophically in order to move the legislation forward to solve the issue. And that's what's not occurring today in Washington, in the United States Congress, and in the legislative arena, or between the President and the Congress. So ultimately, the American people are victims to this polarization and partisanship.
Well, victims, yes. And I think I'm not far off the track when I suggest that the American public is really rapidly losing faith in government and its ability to get anything done.
That is the most disturbing net effect of the polarization and the partisanship, is the public's loss of faith and confidence in their elected officials and their governing institutions. And that's what needs to be reversed. And the only way that can be reversed is in the hands of those who are elected, and who will be elected in this election this year, and whether or not they're prepared to jettison the politics of the past and move this country forward by willing to work with the other side. It's not remarkable that there are differences. The question is whether or not you're prepared to work with the other side to resolve those differences. And unfortunately, somehow this whole process is morphed into, all about the politics and how you get elected and what's going to be in the next 30-second soundbite for the next election than it is about solving the problems for the country. And that's why the public has rightfully lost confidence, because they don't see the connection between what Congress is doing and not doing and the world in which they live on a daily basis. And there are a lot of different issues and difficult issues that the public's facing day in and day out. And yet there's this big disconnect between Congress and the public, because the Congress isn't working on those issues. They're not working on the issues in a way that would suggest they're trying to solve the problems. It's all about advancing their political and philosophical agendas.
You know, I'm going to quote you here. I've read something that you had written in which you say, "For change to occur, our leaders must understand that there is not only strength in compromise, courage in conciliation, and honor in consensus building, but also a political reward for following these tenets." My voice here, for many, the only political reward, which I believe is what you've been saying, is reelection. Okay, so how do we change that? I mean, they're going to have to come to some agreement to change. I see nothing indicating that's going to happen before or after November 4th.
Well, a number of people feel like you do, Don, in that regard, because they don't have any hope that it can change. But again, it does get back to all of us participating in the elections, casting a vote, and making those who are elected accountable for their behavior while they're in Congress. In other words, you're going to make sure that they're there in Washington focusing on the issues that matter, and they're bringing up those issues, that they're willing to work with the other side. You can use social media to convey your views. You can build, you know, online communities in that regard today, and communicating with others who feel similarly that, you know, either Congress is working on these issues or they're not, and what they're going to do to get their members of Congress, their elected officials, accountable, held accountable for their actions or lack of actions in Congress. In other words, you know, why are they on recesses all the time? I mean, that's one of the issues that the Bipartisan Policy Center, which I'm affiliated with, we're coming up with 5-day work weeks, because we think that's important, that members of Congress spend some time in Washington, focus on these issues, get to know one another, use the committee process again, because that's not working, and making members of Congress responsible for bringing up legislative issues that are important to this country. Because that's why I think people have lost faith, is that they don't see anything changing, but it's up to us to make sure that we weigh in to force that change.
You know, we've had the opportunity here on this program to talk to a number of candidates prior to the election, a lot of third-party candidates and a lot of long-shot candidates. And one of the things that has impressed me about them is they really feel that if they are elected, they can make a difference. And I just wonder how realistic that is. It occurs to me that it's probably wishful thinking.
Well, Don, it isn't if they make it so. In joining with other colleagues and encouraging other colleagues to work together on the issues and not to accept the status quo. In other words, sometimes that means imparting your views to the leadership or to your fellow colleagues in a Republican or Democratic conference, expressing to them their frustrations as they're not addressing issues in a way that's consistent with the legislative process and reflective of the desires of your constituency. Is building support among your colleagues to work together on issues and restoring the committee process so that the rank and file are involved in considering legislation and modifying it, amending it, and doing the same on the floor of the House and the Senate, so that that builds not only consensus, but it also allows the rank and file to participate in the legislative process. That's not occurring today. But each member of Congress is responsible for making sure that that process is working and restoring that process if it isn't. And it clearly isn't today. I mean, why I left the Senate was because it became abundantly clear that it would not change. And now I want to encourage people to understand that, one, it has been different. We should not accept it this way, that we have the ability to affect and influence change. And those who are elected are responsible and accountable to those who voted for them. And you have to make them accountable. And we should reward those who are willing to work across the aisle and join in bipartisan efforts to move the process forward and pass legislation that's important to this country, and penalize those who don't. But if we stand on the sidelines, then nothing is going to change. And that's the point, because then you do have a small fractious minority that ultimately is dictating and determining the destiny of this country. And we've seen the net effect of that today. I mean, we're all penalized by the failures of what's occurring in Washington.
But what brought us to this point? I mean, your reputation is such and well known that you were able to work and very effectively across the aisle. That stopped, and that's why you left the U.S. Senate. What brought us to the point where that no longer worked?
Well, it's probably a combination of events and situations that evolved over time. You know, it didn't transform overnight, but I would say there was more polarization in the campaigns because of the influence of outside groups who were running these third-party ads that, unfortunately, we saw plenty of in this election, where upwards of $1 billion could have been expended in this election with respect to outside groups running ads, 90% of which are attack ads. And that has a spillover in the legislative process. One, from the standpoint, people don't forget, it poisons the environment and the atmosphere for collaboration and consensus. But also, these outside groups that ultimately are the ones that, you know, are supporting these candidates. And so members of Congress become risk adverse because now they know that they have these groups that could run ads against them. So therefore, they're more concerned about their reelections than they are about taking the risk of working across the political aisle. The red states have become redder and the blue states have become bluer. And you get this in the media as well, the polarization and the dichotomy that exists with both sides. There's no glory, unfortunately, these days working across the aisle without running the risk of strong opposition, particularly in the primaries, where most of the polarizing candidates run and win because of support from these third-party groups that raise millions of dollars, and ultimately win the general election. So they come to Congress with, you know, that polarizing mentality that ultimately has overtaken the legislative process.
I see a certain amount of irony, though, in the fact that while there is this struggle cycle to cycle to become reelected, with redistricting going the way it's been going for the last generation or better part of a generation, so many of the people who are running are assured of victory.
That's correct, for that very reason. And many of those candidates who emerge from the primary are more likely to be the winners in the general election. They ultimately dictate who serves in the House and Senate. And that's why I certainly advocate open primaries, for example, and independent redistricting commissions. And these are two of the recommendations our Bipartisan Policy Center's Commission on Political Reform, which I co-chaired, has proposed, because we really have to change the dynamic in the primary and to encourage broader participation, because the dynamic in the primary is what's influencing not only who gets elected in the final analysis, but also the legislative process and the atmosphere in the United States Congress, because they're more beholden to those who cast their votes in the primary, which is a much more polarizing electorate and fewer, than they are to the broader population. And therefore, they don't take the risk of working across the political aisle because they're much more responsive to those who elected them in the primary.
The primary is the election in so many cases.
That's right. That's exactly correct. And ultimately, that's why you see that reflected in the legislative process in Congress, because all of the issues and the votes and the amendments that are presented to members of Congress are cast in an either-or situation, my way or the highway, because they don't want to bridge the divide and sort of reconcile the differences anymore, but rather they want to put them all-or-nothing strategy so they can take it to the next election to appeal to that polarizing base and to the ideological views of their party as opposed to the broader population. And that's what's happened, because the risk, members of Congress fear the greater risk of being opposed in a primary than they do in the general election. And so that's why everything is narrowly tailored to that primary voter, of which there are so few, by the way.
Exactly.
Get out and participate in a political primary. That's why we're also proposing a single primary day for congressional candidates. So similar to a Super Tuesday in the presidential primaries, that we would have a sort of a Super Tuesday congressional primary, rather than having them spread between March and September of the year. That way would bring more focus and awareness that these primaries are occurring, you know, encourage broader participation, more people casting their votes in a primary, and elevate the issues, and also to expose the candidates more to a broader population at hand.
Along with this part of the discussion, then I would bring into it the fact that there are so many attempts across the country to actually restrict the number of people who can vote. I mean, voter ID laws and photo IDs and, you know, pre-election day voting is being resisted in so many parts of the country today, and that would help accomplish what you've just said.
Absolutely, they would, Don. The issues that you raise are barriers to garnering more voter participation. And the fact is we need to remove those barriers. And that's why we were talking about, as one of the recommendations, of not only having states work in a cooperative fashion to align their lists, you know, to identify inaccuracies and duplications, but also to have online registration, for example. Another way, in this medium today, of technology and the internet, we ought to be able to register people online so that we're encouraging registering for voting, for example. But you're absolutely right. We've got to find ways in which people are going to be able to participate. Frankly, you know, I would happen to support, you know, voting on Saturdays. Maybe that's a better way of getting more people involved in casting their ballots and making it easier so that they have the opportunity to be able to vote. So those are some of the issues that we are looking at, early voting as well, because we think that that is another avenue for getting people to be able to participate and hopefully be able to vote.
If I may say so, it seems to me, if what I read is correct, that it is your party, the Republican Party in so many cases, that are putting up these barriers.
Well, unfortunately, that has been the case in many instances. And frankly, I think that that frankly contravenes, I think, what we should stand for as a party. Frankly, I think it's more important for us to be doing everything we can to encourage people to vote. Are there issues in voting? And we can identify and mitigate some of the issues with respect to fraud. And we, in fact, propose that in our Commission on Political Reform report. There are ways in which to align our efforts state by state in order to make that happen. But in the meantime, it is also important to ensure that people are registering to vote and participating, enabling them to do so, and to removing the barriers that prevent them from doing so.
Apparently, there's not a whole lot of fraud going on. Again, from what we read, that there are a minimum number of cases nationwide documented of voter fraud.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'd like to move on to something else. If on November 4th, the GOP does win control of the Senate, as many think is a strong possibility, what would you expect to happen? Would you expect something like the Affordable Care Act, for instance, to be basically dismantled, other Democratic programs dismantled?
Well, I certainly would think that Republicans would want to demonstrate, first and foremost, their ability to govern, since they will be controlling the legislative branch of government if they recapture the majority in the United States Senate along with the majority in the House of Representatives. So it would be absolutely an imperative for Republicans to do everything they can to dispel some of the perceptions that have emerged as a result of, you know, some of the actions taken in the previous Congress, such as the shutdown, and what they can do to be constructive and cooperative in restoring the legislative process consistent with the norms and traditions of each of the institutions of Congress in the House and the Senate. I think that's going to be critically important, so that on the issues such as the Affordable Care Act, are there areas in which that need to be addressed? I think absolutely. My guess is that eventually they'll move in that direction, is trying to address and remedy some of the problems that have emerged with the Affordable Care Act, where they can reach a consensus. My guess is that there would be bipartisan support to repeal the medical device tax. That's where there seemed to have been agreement even last time on a bipartisan basis, but for some reason never been able to execute. So even though there may be some votes on repealing the Affordable Care Act, I think in the final analysis, they recognize that they're not going to be, you know, obviously repealing the Affordable Care Act. That's not a winning or achievable strategy. It wasn't last time. It's not going to be this time, because obviously the president would veto it. So the question is now to be constructive in their approach and addressing some of those issues where they can achieve bipartisan agreement, where they recognize there are some issues that need to be identified, and there are, and move forward in that fashion, and building the kind of confidence that I think is going to be essential for the Republicans to demonstrate that they have the capacity to govern, and it is consistent with the trust that has been vested in them by the fact that they now have the majority in both the House and Senate.
Do we need more women in politics and at a higher level? We are told that women are better at compromising and nurturing and getting along, and that perhaps that's the answer to the problem that started this discussion.
Well, that could be, Don. That's true. You're right. I mean, you know, it's always good to have more women in the process. We need more voices at the table. We need our political institutions to be reflective of our population, without question. And certainly, it was a pleasure to work with the women I did in the Senate and in the House. They are collaborative, and, you know, obviously, we didn't always agree, and it would be difficult to always be homogenous with any group, but certainly we always had people who were willing to listen, and you always built, I think, a fertile environment for collaboration and consensus building, given the relationships that we had with one another in the Senate. So it built up a camaraderie and respect for one another, even if we couldn't always agree. And I think that's the key here, is respecting the differences that each of us have, but how we reconcile those differences for the greater good of the country. And that's what's not occurring. And I think people are just fearful of the fact that they have a governing process now where you have the inability of both sides to come together for the common good of the country.
My last question. Two women getting a lot of attention these days are Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren. What do you see in their future?
Well, I think that I think that Elizabeth Warren obviously has a great future in the United States Senate, and I think my guess is, I don't know, that Hillary will be running for the presidency on the Democratic ticket. And I have the great admiration for Hillary and have enormous respect for her. I enjoyed working with her in the Senate and actually got to know her when President Clinton was governor because my husband was governor at the same time. So Hillary and I got to know each other in the Spouses Association of the National Governors Association originally. And then she was elected to the Senate in 2000 when I was running for re-election, and my husband ran into President Clinton. He says, "My, how things have changed. They used to be the spouses, and now we're the spouses."
Very interesting. And I have to think that, however, that if she does run, she probably will not be getting Olympia Snow's vote. Don't want to put you on the spot on that. But I'm so appreciative of the time you've spent with us, Senator Snow. And I know there are a lot of people listening to this program who wish you were still in the U.S. Senate because you seem to make an awful lot of sense.
Well, thank you, Don. It's been my pleasure and looking forward to the visit. I'm very excited about it, and I thank you.
We will look forward to that. Thank you, Olympia Snow.
Thank you.
Former Republican Senator Olympia Snow of Maine. She's the author of Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress, and she'll be in town November 14th to keynote the Umzel Center for Ethics and Public Life Conference on the Ethics of Political Dysfunction. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about racial inequality in public education and ways to address that issue. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks for listening. I'm Don Marsh.